Last year, we spoke at length about this wonderful project of Nutrition Smart Communities with the support of Welthungerhilfe India. Recently, I caught up with Saroj and Philippe to get an idea on how the project was developing and what factors had come to the fore from which similar projects could learn. In truth, so many topics are congested into this brief hour. I strongly recommend focusing on some of the lessons learned from the Nutrition Smart community. We could all benefit from picking up good habits. Thank you so much, Saroj and Philippe. It's brilliant catching up with you and learning from your wisdom and experience. Tuna Mike, no longer clocking out. Rise up.
Don't wish a peck, goodwill, mabiro, to under Mike. Don't parody, cut joke, mawoy, to under Mike. Say, jetting suit, buta, wawinji, to under Mike. All our joke, wabed pee, be wawinji, to under Mike. Rochako, to under Mike. No mate, indeed, to and a Mike. Podcast, Makende.
1 year ago, we had two wonderful discussions about a fantastic project taking place in India. And those conversations occurred with Saroj and Philippe. And both of you are back again for another conversation about these topics. I'm really happy to have you back. So both of you, Saroj and Philippe, welcome.
Thank you, Zach.
Thank you, Zach.
Yeah, it's always funny. Okay, we do it one by one. Thank you. Okay, Saroj, you as last year and again this year, you've been the catalyst, the inspiration behind you bringing us together to have this conversation. So obviously, thank you for doing so again. Would you like to talk us about what updates you have from your side about the project and also perhaps what you've been doing?
Yes. First of all, thank you so much for bringing up the topic and talking about that. Let's talk about an update from this project, because it has been and will always be a project that's very, very close to my heart. And I have not been able to do much with Philip. I'm working with Save the Children, and it has been a crazy ride for the last year. It's a lot of digital projects that need to be done. Mm-hmm. And I have been supporting the project, not physically, not financially, but more emotionally. I get updates sometimes and I read through it and I get very happy about what's happening. And that's why it will also be today, after many, many days, I myself will be getting an update and I'm very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's wonderful when that kind of comes together, isn't it? We have, sometimes, I don't know, there may be some kind of mystical power which operates in a certain way, and we get together and we have a conversation, and then it's like, oh, okay, so how's Philip? And it's, oh, well, that's, and I think that happens, and I enjoy that. Philip, how about you? It's great I'm really happy, because Saroj and I, we're both in Berlin, so we have the opportunity to communicate more frequently. With you, it's much more difficult for us to communicate. How have you been? What have you been up to?
I've been fine, quite busy the last months in designing the next phase of the Nutrition Smart Community, which goes beyond the two model villages Saroj is supporting. Oh. And it has been really a deep dive in how to make things better, how to make things different. And the two villages have been really a learning lab for me. I just recently came back from a visit to one of the villages, Patan in Madhya Pradesh. I just got an update 2 days ago from Shweta, who's a coordinator. She gave me an update on the second village, Burudi, which is in Jharkhand. And she came back, by the way, from Sierra Leone, where she introduced the same or supporting the same Nutrition Smart Community approach in some villages in the country. And she was completely excited that it also works in Africa, not only in Asia. And she came back with a lot of interesting best practices and ideas. So everything is okay. And a lot, of course, has happened in a positive manner, but also things where I was thinking we need to do things differently. Maybe we can also discuss it.
Saroj, you know things much better than I do. So I think maybe this section I could completely leave to you to ask these questions.
To taking an update. No, I'm very impressed because the moment you say, oh, you tried it in two villages and then you move to a third village, that also probably happened, but you moved to another country and it also worked, which means the idea is scalable, which proves how good it was, the basis is. Of course, you have to always fix and change and adapt to the regions, but the basic idea foundation is strong, which I'm very, very impressed with.
No, I think the core approach really works. And I mean, it has been an evolution also, you know, starting with a more integrated rural development approach. And then we went into a multi-sectoral approach to really get the different sectors together, to link them with each other. Then we entered into a food system approach to see the local food system as a whole. And to concentrate on these four dimensions, nutrition, education, and eco-literacy, then of course food and nutrition governance, regenerative agriculture, and then last but not least, equitable livelihoods, and to really think what are the interventions which we need to do, and also to interlink the different dimensions with each other. So that works. And I think now the next step is a transformative approach. So how do we scale it? So how do we really create systemic change? And that was quite a headache for me, but quite interesting. But maybe I just give you a short update. So we had the inception phase. I think beginning of last year, we talked about it. And now we call it the maintenance phase, where we basically have established these two core groups, the advisory committee and the youth group. And I think the next year would be the graduation phase, where we slowly will, you know, reduce our support and then hand over to the community, to the groups themselves, and where the local NGO won't play this big role as they have played so far. But looking at the committees and the youth groups, it's quite amazing. They are meeting on a regular basis now. They evaluate and they discuss, you know, the outcome and the impact of the activities with the other village groups, you know, during so-called national celebration days. So that's always a reminder for them. So they have the health and nutrition day, they have the women's day, or the water day, where they discuss the different issues. And in Burundi, they even have introduced a new day. They call it the village day or the village development day, where they reflect, you know, then on the overall development of the community, and they also revise the village development plan, which we have talked about last year. So quite nice to see the strong linkages they have created, you know, with the government. So they have now, they are being supported by multiple government projects. They are active in multiple income generations and infrastructure intervention. So that's really nice. And the youth group in Burundi, for example, they're organizing a sewing class. Some of them are attending an hospitality management training, which they have organized and connected to. Both villages now having computer classes and English classes. They really try also to speak English with us when we are coming. So that's really, really nice to see. But also the farmers now, they're really shifting from conventional agriculture to organic farming. And most of them have gradually now diversified their crops and they're replacing the hybrid plants now with local traditional indigenous varieties. And yes, we talked about localization of food. So it's really nice to see that, especially in Burundi, they really have revitalized and rediscovered this local rice varieties, which are amazing. They are now connected to a social business called Bumika, which we also have created under one of our program and for marketing purposes. And these are two indigenous rice varieties, which they are now selling in the region. So that's something really, really nice to see. Another thing which I was completely surprised was the infrastructure development is when I went to Patan in Madhya Pradesh. I mean, health center is not well equipped and functioning with regular checkups, and they have biogas plants everywhere, which is amazing. Solar-powered streetlights, also supported by private companies, are available. They have these zero energy cooling chambers. That's how we call it, to keep, you know, fruits, vegetables, and other items fresh without using electricity. So that's quite interesting. Water testing is done on a regular basis, which is nice. And almost all households, I would say, have access to say drinking water as well. So in fact, some of the household, or a lot of the household, have now even a water connection at home, which I was quite impressed to see, supported by the government. And all of these householders have nutrition gardens, you know. So that's really nice. School education has also undergone a real transformation. Yeah. So school buildings have been renovated, and school attendance is now properly monitored by the school management committee, and the shortage of teacher also has been addressed. We also talked about it, so that was quite positive to see. And the children are screened on a monthly basis, you know, with a government child care workers, the Anganwadis, that's how they're called in India. And we can proudly say that none of the children are today undernourished or malnourished. So that's really positive. So, yeah, so they have been quite busy. So the villages have really evolved into attractive learning hubs. Yeah, so many people are coming now. We are still waiting for you, Saroj. We really have to come. I think we had visitors from Africa. We had visitors from all over India. NGOs are coming. Government officials are regularly visiting. We're expecting our visitors from Tajikistan. There are a couple of NGOs who will come end of the month. And next month, I think also visitors from Myanmar. So yes, so they're slowly even doing a business model out of these, you know, exposure visits, the youth groups. Yeah. And it's quite nice to see how they are engaged now, even in social media. They have, you know, Instagram handle, and they're on WhatsApp and Facebook, and they're promoting these villages, creating information material, brochures, etc., and organizing these visits. So that's also quite positive to see. Yeah.
Wow. This is so much going on. I was just trying to figure out, wow, it's like I've written in my last article, it's like being a superpower, a hero. It's like a hero. But I still like to use the word holistic approach, which I still see here. You're taking care of health and nutrition, which is the basic agenda of Welthunger Helfer. So that's, of course, plus water. But you're also taking care of sustainable energy, infrastructure, skill building, education, and also making sure that the accountability lies with the government, which is one of the biggest points that sometimes is missing when international NGOs are active in a area. And that's so important, because once you leave, those will be the agencies that will be supporting. And if they don't get involved from the start, they don't feel accountable for the change. So this is so important that you, and I can't repeat myself enough. I'm so impressed. also that you're doing the continuous monitoring and with Bhumika, which means there is some capability for them to learn how to earn money out of, I'm guessing.
So the business aspect is getting more and more important. So we have had a very strong focus on nutrition education and agriculture, of course, in the last first years, and also nutrition governance played a role. We, you know, capacitated these community-based institutions. They have these, you know, nutrition and wash committees, for example. So that was a big focus, but the problem was always a bit, and we have neglected it, we haven't done too much. And I think the marketing aspects needs to be, it's important. And that's where I also feel that we need to focus more on a sub-regional approach. The village, I mean, the place-based approach is great because you can see that, you know, innovation and technologies are happening in a fast-moving cycle, so you can see the impact right away, and you can fine-tune it when you have a good, you know, monitoring and feedback loops in place. But you need to step out, especially when you are following a systems approach, a food systems approach, and to really consider the region. So we are already working in a cluster of villages, but much more emphasis needs to be done in defining what is really the sub-region, you know, what, you know, glues as a region, and what are the, you know, what is the identity of the region in terms of ecosystem. Some of them have a common forest. Or there's a huge lake where different villages have access to, or there's a common watershed, or even a cultural identity. I mean, especially the Burundi tribe, they have one culture. And then, of course, to also create collectives, federations of farmers, to bring them together in improving market access. I think that's something I realized. And that's what we also would like to do in the future, but to have a more focus on getting more organized on a sub-regional level. The problem is that most of the time these administrative boundaries are not very useful for us. So to really have more landscape approach, a sub-regional approach, and then to get a representation in place where a sub-region can have a bargaining power, can be in touch with a district, or even with a higher level governance and marketing structures.
Probably makes it a bit more difficult because you'll have to deal with two governments and not the one that you normally
deal with. So we are calling it now the community collective. So where we have a farmer federation representing the Nutrition Smart Community region in Madhya Pradesh and of course, in Jharkhand. In Jharkhand, it's a bit more tricky because we don't have the Nutrition Smart Community per se as a region. In Madhya Pradesh, it's easier. And then also to have a strong women representation, self-help representation within the community collective. To really empower then the collective in doing the monitoring, providing training, and creating also multiple learning and knowledge hub within the region. What I also found, and maybe these are a little bit not the negative sides, but the lessons learned, that the focus on one village also can cause conflicts because a lot of attention, a lot of funding, a lot of support is going into one community. Mm-hmm. They were able to make a big, you know, noise. And I can see that the neighboring villages are a little bit, you know, there is some jealousy coming up, and we need to, in terms of conflict sensitivity, we need to be careful. And I think it's better to embrace a region. And also we stopped calling the model villages. We are using the term learning hubs, and to have maybe even multiple learning hubs in one region, that we shift away from this model village where too much attention is also not good at the end.
Yeah. That's amazing. Zach, I have one more question and then I'll give the mic back to you. I'm sorry. I'm so excited about this. One point, I like it that because there was this model village project from Zach, from Jeffrey, long time ago.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what, this was the learning from, because they focused on one village and then the neighboring villages were not involved and felt even more backward than they felt before, because now the bar is higher. And so great, thank you for even considering that, and really like the approach. You said one thing about the next year handover. Would you like to go more into that? What does that mean when you say that you will get out of the project, and what effect does it have?
So we have created now this quite strong collaborative or supportive network, you know, between the village and their respective self-help groups and CBOs, community-based organizations, the local NGO, the government, but also the private sector. The local NGO still plays a pivotal key role, I would say, especially when it comes to fundraising and stakeholder coordination. And I think that's something slowly we need to hand over to the community, that they will be able to do the fundraising without the NGO involved, but also then to reach out to different stakeholders from the government and the private sector, of course. And here we need to see, I mean, what we have done now, and I think that was an interesting move, is to create these advisory committees, because the local government, or the local government structure in India, we call it the panchayats, they are elected leaders. It's very conflictive. It's very difficult. So yeah, we faced some conflicts within the communities as well, different groups. It's very politicized. But the advisory committee, we have different peoples who have more a development agenda in mind. They're farmer representative, women representative, youth, some business people. So it's a mixture of also some senior people from the government, the teachers, well-recognized personalities, I would say. I think that's something we have to further support, because they bring a more genuine agenda on board. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that would be the main challenge or the main focus next year. The graduation phase, that's an invention of Sweta, that's how she calls it, the last phase, where we slowly hand over, and maybe with also the idea of the collectives and maybe to further empower these advisory committees and the youth groups in doing fundraising maybe in the future. I think we are on the right track. And of course, we will never disappear completely. We will always have an eye on. And the support is so minimal. I mean, financially, there is barely any support. There are one or two field officers from the local NGO, and that's it. I mean, the main resources are coming from CSR, coming from the government, and not from Welthungerhilfe or the local partner.
I think that's a good thing to go to you, Zach, because we talked before about decolonization, localization, which this kind of leads to, not shifting
exactly
from the NGO to the local organizations. Please, Zach.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's a great way to lead in. I just had a couple of questions with regards to what Philip had mentioned, and then I'd love to engage in this the debate about that particular terminology. But the structure that has been created within the villages. So you mentioned committees, you mentioned collectives, you mentioned regional government, and what are the sort of structural governance systems that you've introduced? As in, how much say do the people on the ground in the hubs have for the direction that the future project takes? And then on top of that, sharing knowledge. One of the things which I find most helps with sustainability is the willingness to part with knowledge, the willingness to give information to other people to help them grow, and not to manage and gatekeep access to that knowledge. And is that also that sharing element sort of inherent within the structure to assist these other villages in the area to grow with them?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The sharing element is okay, I would say. You know, I mean, they're proud. People are coming, people are visiting the villages. The youth are getting exposed to a larger community. There's a lot of interaction, a lot of networking going on. So I think it's a positive. That has a positive impact, and there's not the feeling that oops, we shouldn't share, and it's a secret, and we are doing better than the others, but we should continue, but let's not share our knowledge or the approach we are following. When it comes to the government structure, we are basically following the Indian governance system, with the panchayat, the CBOs, which are also in place and regulated by the government. And then, of course, we connect to the district departments and the local departments of the government, which are in place, and the local private stakeholders, which are interested in collaborating. What we have done, and we have, you know, this is the focus on youth groups, which I really like because we didn't have it before. And they bring a total new dynamic and new ideas and a lot of energy into the game. And like I said, the advisory committee, which I also found interesting because they are supporting the rollout of the village development plan, which the panchayat holds. They are the owner of the plan, and the rollout or the implementation of the plan is done by the different CBOs and self-help groups. But still, the advisory committee has a look and is a bit monitoring and advising and giving new ideas on how the plan can be refined or the activities can be improved. So that's something good. My problem is a little bit, and I think we also discussed it recently, Saroj, is a monitoring system. So how do we create a feasible community-based monitoring system which people can handle? Our monitoring system is tough, and I'm really still struggling with it. We are having a monitoring system based on 10 indicators, which is integrated in a Power BI dashboard. So we have developed a ComCare app. It took us some time, quite complex, and the indicators are covering multiple specific disciplines such as nutrition, agriculture, WASH, education, infrastructure, and economic development. Most of the indicators are quite complex. If we are talking about minimal acceptable diets or minimum diversity, dietary diversity for women of reproductive age, that's one indicator as well. It's not so easy to collect these data. They're quantitative data. And sometimes I'm also thinking, if I see then the pie chart, you know, in the dashboard, so what does it really tell me? Are we on track? Are we really transforming the system in the villages? I don't know. And maybe we need to simplify it further and to also introduce more more human indicators or warm indicators, that's how I call it, qualitative indicators. I'm not so sure where we can really also see what are the dynamics, the systems dynamics in the communities, and where we can better monitor, relationships, biodiversity, resilience, so these kind of more systemic issues, which with these quantitative indicators, we cannot really do, even if we triangulate and compare these indicators, which is very, very difficult. So sometimes we are drowning in data and informations while starving for wisdom. And the wisdom is not yet there, and I think we still need to try out, and especially when it comes to localization, how does a community track their transformation journey and really see that they are on track? Data collection reduced to a minimum, but because actually the government, they should track, and they're doing it already in India. They have introduced a couple of apps. They have the government workers, they have the Poshan Abhiyan track to track malnutrition done by the Anganwadi workers. So that shouldn't also be the role of an NGO or an INGO. So still some work to be done. I'm not 100% happy, but yes, it's a work in progress.
Now we've also introduced my last word that wasn't in the thing, is digitalization. So it's also happening, crazy. But impact measurement has been a huge issue generally as well in NGO. It's not as easy as just quantitative, where you do business, where you have a baseline and then quantitative is easy to measure, but there's most of the work is qualitative, and how do you actually put numbers behind it or make it more readable or understandable for a person who has never been there but is donating and has been. So I would love to be a part of the group where you brainstorm about what could be the best best UPI for this quantitative measure. So Philip, if you have an idea, please let me know.
So we are a little bit working on it. We are developing and we call it an agroecological food system assessment tool, which will be more participatory and where we will focus more on, you know, on case studies, on storytelling, on interviews with the people to really also discuss, you know, what are the power dynamics in your village. Stakeholder mapping also plays an important role. These kind of things, which goes then beyond these quantitative indicators. I think they're still important, but we need to reduce them to one or two, I would say, to really measure the long-term impact. But when it comes to constant monitoring of your process and your interventions, I think these quantitative data are not very helpful, because it just gives you a snapshot of in a specific point of time only. So you know what's going on, but you still don't know if you are contributing to long-term sustainability, for example.
Yeah, I mean, so many topics to jump into perhaps and analyze further. Probably we're not going to have the time to be able to do that, but these are great topics to talk about. Also, when you were discussing qualitative or quantitative, it kind of reminded me of a completely different area when I was studying law and the interpretation of law. And sometimes one method is to take a very sort of literal approach, and you just simply look at the raw words and you follow the words. But then the other, perhaps more creative and meaningful approach, is to understand, well, what was the actual intention of the law? And is this case being followed from within that? And whether or not that can also be attributed to data, as in, what is the intention behind the data being collected? If it's simply just because it's countable, but does that actually provide us with any kind of meaningful analysis for later on, if you see what I mean?
That's correct. Very good point.
True. And at the end, I mean, we are talking about and a food system or a community is a social ecological system. It's a dynamic network of mainly human relationships, you know. Relationships and processes and their interact with each other to create patterns of behavior over time. So at the end, it boils down to humans, how they are interconnected and how they are interacting based on specific worldviews, you know, because a relationship is driven by a worldview. And if you have different worldviews, things are not really happening, and to work on these worldviews is important, and because they will then shape values and principles, and values and principles will guide behavior, and again, they will create a behavior pattern which will then define the overall system you would like to transform, and which I also realized last year how important it is to work on quality relations. And sometimes we have the tendencies, especially NGOs, to jump into activities. We love activities. We're activists. So you need to do a school program, and then we have to work on sustainable agricultural practices. We have to introduce new technologies, and we need an app, and then we have to monitor everything, and we have to create a new governance systems, and then work on a value chain. And I think it's sometimes also overwhelming for the communities. And another thing which I realize that we are very problem oriented. So when we do an assessment, we develop a logical framework, that's how we call it, when we are developing our proposals to get funding from institutional donors. And it's all about problems. And also our indicators are based on problems. And I think sometimes it's better to first look what are really the potential in a village, and that not with a huge back of problems where the motivation drops already. You know, oh, you're malnourished, oh, you have no toilets, open defecation is an issue. You can see already when you talk to the villagers, oh my God, you know, what a fun. but if you talk about something they like or they're good at, and they have maybe some indigenous seed which are still available and they're proud about it, and then you talk about why don't we create together a seed bank, and then you create a seed bank and you talk about maybe we can do some money, a business with it, you know, and sell it to other farmers, and maybe we invite also a school that they can learn about ecology or traditional ecosystems and farming systems. And so slowly, I think, you know, you create this systemic approach where you tackle different dimensions, but you have one key intervention, which is will be defined by the community themselves because they like it. And I think that creates more dynamics than this huge, sometimes, problems over problems, and then you get lost in different processes and activities, and step by step is, I think, better.
And then going back to then what Saraj suggested, because it's also inherent within the conversation that we're having. So when we were talking about topics, you placed localization policies as one of the most important themes for us to look at here. Mm. And then when I was going through additional background, I came across the Welthungerhilfe India website, where there is a very prominently placed topic called decolonizing food. But they are more or less the same themes, from what I understood from our conversation before we started recording.
I'm not such a huge fan of the word decolonization, because then again, it's a little bit a blaming game which starts, and that we all know that it's the Western countries who have done a lot of mistakes. I think we are all aware of it. But I prefer the word localization, because we all need to localize. Also, the Western countries need to localize. We have all the same problems at the end. You know, we are sitting all in the same boat called planet Earth, and we all know that we need to recreate these decentralized regions which are more or less independent and which are, of course, and connected to a bigger region, and then connected to global supportive networks, or however you call it. But that's a problem we are all facing, and we all need to work on. So localization, I think it's a better word. Decolonization is always a little bit, I know what is, of course, and we have the companies now, but now they also, you have Indian companies who are dictating rural areas and communities what to eat or what to grow. So it's not only a Western problem, I would say. It's a global issue which we all have to address.
It's a problem of power, and that's why I like when you talk about localization. The definition that I read somewhere was decolonizing aid and shifting power to local organizations. So it's about power shifting. And that's why I really like what you said, Philip, before about we look at the problems, but we should be looking at the potentials rather, because that's when we shift power. When we're looking at the problems, we are telling another person, you have a problem and I will help you to solve it. I'm already putting myself at a higher position. But when I'm talking about potential, I'm saying, okay, I see something in you that you probably don't see. Let me help you, which already puts us in the power shifts automatically to you being being an aid and not a leader.
And I think that's what's slowly happening, and it's a nice development where people slowly create, including my organization, globally connected networks, you know, of locally adapted community and regions that value local and regional solutions through global collaboration. And I think that's something we all need to support to create these, you know, platforms where communities can connect to and seek support or inspiration in terms of not only funding, but of knowledge and support, technical ideas, innovation, and so on. And even international corporations are slowly also shifting and from dominant players to more collaborative partners, where they provide essential tools, platforms, very specialized services to smaller stakeholders, decentralized regions or communities. And I think that's a way forward, rather than a company doing everything, dominating the whole value chain. So let the community decide, and we create the supportive ecosystem. And I think that's a changing role, where then we again work in a multi-stakeholder setup and where different people are connected with each other.
I have to say, I really like both terms. I like the positive element of localization, because that also allows us to focus on really the people that are there. And I think that they the people involved within these projects really have to remain the focal points. And it's, you know, this is being done for them, and this is being done for the generations that will stem from the relationships and lifestyles that they create. I also think that decolonialization and decolonizing food as political terms, perhaps as historically accurate analyses, have a place within the general conversation. I don't want to take that down a negative path, but I do want to make sure that the histories are not forgotten. And the reason why, for me, this is an issue is we're kind of seeing at the moment in the United States under the new administration that they are completely trying to revise history. They're trying to point towards a history which did not exist. They're removing important characters from the achievements of previous administrations, previous times. And to do that, in my opinion, can only lead us towards further racialized struggles in the future. But I really like the fact that you're looking at this not through that politicized lens, but really from the perspective of the actual project. So perhaps decolonizing has a role, but in a different part of this book.
Exactly. I think we are now in living in a transitional phase, and we are living between two worldviews. You know, one is a worldview of the ego, and the other one is a worldview of you know, regeneration and based on ecological principle. I think we are on the brink of a new revolution. I call it the systems revolution, where reconnection, integrating Western modern science with traditional ecological knowledge, with indigenous knowledge, but also with Eastern spiritual traditions, you know, will be an important aspect. And I think we don't need to abolish everything we have done yesterday. A lot of good things have happened. And now there's a little bit the tendency of the forces who want to keep the old worldview alive, maybe even in with total disruption, social revolution or whatever, civil unrest and civil wars, and then to rebuild a world which will be then based on a worldview from yesterday again. I was just listening to Elon Musk a couple of days ago. He was telling that empathy is the biggest weakness of Western society. I mean, so we have these old ego-dominated forces from the old worldview who wants to keep, you know, the old system alive, no matter what it costs. Yes, and this transitional phase hasn't been easy so far, because we as NGOs, we try to fix a little bit the problem of the past. We all know that the old system didn't work. Capitalism didn't really work in terms of environment. We have the climate change. We have the pollution aspect. We have the inequalities and so on. So we tried to repair a little bit the disorder which we have created. That also led, I have to say, to a bit cancel culture or the wokeness tradition, which is criticized. And yeah, and of course we tried to regulate, that made these the phase quite stressful also for NGOs working on sustainability and so on. And now I think we really have to again work on a new worldview, a regenerative worldview, where systems design based development plays a role based on ecological principles, where we reconnect with nature and we create a new knowledge. I think things are already happening in terms of economies, circularities, bioeconomies. There are a lot of ideas around. But yes, now it's disruption, but I'm positive that we'll have a new phase coming up, hopefully soon. And I mean, when we see it at human history, 90% of our history is Homo sapiens. We lived in harmony with nature, basically, 200,000 years, and we had a strong connection with nature. But then the disconnect happened, the separation between humans and nature, between feminine and masculine, between left brain and right brain, between inner and outer perspectives. And I think now it's time to reconnect again and to build on this huge knowledge which nature and life has generated. And I'm always every day looking into these, you know, ecological principles, because we are working on agriculture. And then you have the principles of interconnectedness, of diversity, of resilience, of regeneration, of circularity, of reciprocity, of adaptation, of abundance, you know, of cooperation, symbiosis, etc. And I think, and let's program our AI and to work in accordance with these principles. And I think then we would be on good terms. But I think it will take some time. And interestingly, we have the climate change, the agricultural revolution was also based on a climate crisis. So we had the end of the Ice Age, which then led to the agricultural revolution. And then 500 years, we had a climate crisis again with a small Ice Age, I think 1450 to 1550. Which then led to the scientific revolution and then the industrial revolution. So that was the starting point of the separation journey. And now, interestingly, we again have a climate crisis, which hopefully will lead to a better worldview. Working on worldviews is more important than ever.
That's
true. To talk about values, what are the values we would like to see and we would like to work on, and of course democracy is one of our biggest values which we have created, and we should protect it as much as possible.
I really liked your point when you talked about agriculture, because it only reminds me my father, because my family is also a farmer family, and when I told him once about the Weltunger help for the project and what they're doing in having private gardens and the technology that they're using, and my father was like, oh, that's what we used to do when we were children. And I said, oh yeah. And so then it was uncool again, and now it's getting cool again, so we have to go back to the roots for sure. I wanted to actually know your view, Philip, on, or Zach, yours as well. So there's a morality in localization, right? There's we do it because it's morally right. But then there is also a force, because it's not really a choice for NGOs, in my opinion, anymore to follow localization, but rather it is also to keep up with the time, to be alive. You kind of have to do it, because the southern world is denying to accept support from the Western countries and saying, no, we're going to build our own called South-South Cooperation, or the development bank, where they don't want to collaborate with countries anymore. If you want to keep up with the agenda that we are following, we kind of have to do to follow the localization path. What do you think about that?
No, definitely, there's no alternative. And like I said, I think it's time now to create these networks of regions, and it can be. I like the eco-region movement or the bio-region movement, which is also taking place in Europe, where these regions are communicating with each other. Sometimes they're even trading with each other and are in touch with each other, learning from each other. And we could do this on a global scale as well, where African regions can learn from Indian regions in terms of sustainability and resilient food systems through a global collaborative network, which I was speaking of. I think we need to really empower these regions because they have a lot to offer. But yes, they disappeared a little bit in the global political scenarios, and it's getting a bit difficult now with the nations playing a huge role again and trying to secure the spheres of power. But at the end, the power should be the local level, and they should drive the agenda, and they should drive transformation and innovation. And basically, that's at the local level. That's where transformation is happening, isn't it? It's not happening at national level. It's not happening on a global level. It's always happening in a specific place where people transform their agricultural system, their food system, their ecosystems, the natural systems, their resources, etc.
My view is that globalization has to deserve our continued support. And at the moment, at the moment, it's not fit for purpose. As in, I'd like to apply some perhaps design thinking elements to globalization. Does it actually match the people that we're supposedly introducing this for? Because it clearly doesn't. We've got international bodies that want to provide funding to individual nations, but at what cost to those nations? We're talking about repayment vehicles, which are going to impoverish these countries for decades. And this has been seen. I love the fact that you've got Ibrahim Traore in Burkina Faso saying, no, we're going to build our future on the back of our own resources, of our own localized knowledge. And I see it not necessarily as a national power grab. I see it as perhaps a more politicized form of localization. These people know really what is best for their local areas. They understand their culture best. They understand the land best. They understand their nature best. I think developing communication and relationships, wonderful. There's never limit to that positive interconnectedness, but trying to then use that as a means to introduce trade through which you can come to dominate different areas, that is a thing of the past, and we should learn of its dangers. So globalization, I think, should be rolled back, definitely pushing localization.
I think so too. Localization or even regionalization, maybe we can call it. Why do we need national state constructs? Let the regions decide where they would like to go. And then, of course, we will still have the multinational corporation. They can then create these platforms, which we are talking about, the specified services. They can introduce innovation technologies, but at the end, the region decide what kind of services they would like to also create, new drive and new competition. So I think that's the way to go. So yes, we need to redefine our globalization. That's true. Yeah. Maybe another aspect, because we are running already out of time, and I think that's also something which is very important and which I also learned while interacting with our model villages we call it food system champions, or agents of change. We all know them. We all know that they're important, but we haven't done much to support them. So what local NGOs are doing, it's because they always have done it. They enter a community, they enter a village, so they always go to the usual suspects, to the CBO members, to the government officials, and they get stuck. But it's always amazing when you dive deeper into the community, to the communities, to you meet these amazing champions. you meet a farmer which has amazing ideas, which is already following a systems approach, or you have a small entrepreneur or ecopreneur who is looking into nutritional aspects, or you have a government secretary who would like to create some more innovative coordination bodies to integrate, you know, different sectors, etc. So to really in a more systematic manner to work with these change agents who have the transformative power, because at the end it's always individuals who are creating change. It's not a process, it's not an NGO. It's a person like Greta Thunberg or Elon Musk, yeah, who are driving the agenda at the end. And the more you have these change agents which are developing the worldview which we were talking about, and you also, you know, connect them with each other, you might create the 10%, you know, of a collective which you need to have this tipping point where system then changes. And because these people will also then motivate others, they have a multiplier effect. The best are these generalists, these, you know, integrators who are not from one sector, but have a little bit more, how shall I say, a wider view and getting people together. But that also requires a lot of capacity building. And I think that's something we are working, or we just have started to create trainings on systems thinking. What does it mean on food system leadership? Because that goes beyond the old traditional leadership style, which you see very often also at community level, which is still very traditional, very top down. And we need a new leadership style based on systems thinking, following these, you know, ecological principles, and where people understand that systems dynamics, have the analytical skills to see the power dynamics, to map the stakeholders, but also to feel the system. Yeah, how do people interact with each other? Are they listening? Do they show empathy? And then last but not least, even, you know, being the system, feeling the system, then it gets a bit spiritual, where you really sense the interconnection with nature, and you have a deep purpose on changing. And I think we are all systems designer, each of us, but some have a stronger purpose than the others. And to create the purpose, that was something we should support and work on it. Yeah.
Mm. Very well said, Philip. Thank you. Saroj, closing thoughts from you, please. You brought us together. You can see us out.
I'm so now deeply in thinking mode about what Philip said. I can only think of India, like it's getting so spiritual, and this is what it's very my thing. But the closing thoughts is, I love the word capacity builders in leadership. I call it good help, bad help. So if you are, the good help involves you being a servant leader and not leader who's telling other people what to do, but rather understanding where the capacity is and then building on it. And I think that's so important. So Philip, we're always of similar opinion, so there's no doubt about it, but you've kind of put it together into words very well. It's very deep and still helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and thank you both of you for taking the time to come and talk with me about it. I Philip, I will trouble you for some of these social media accounts and links, please, to the people who are working in these hubs. You said before that marketing may be one of the things that needs a bit of attention. This could perhaps also be a part of that. When people start to realize exactly, you know, the cool kinds of things that these hubs are doing, and then to be able to interact with them and to spread that information, that knowledge, that hope to other areas where they could communicate directly with these individual actors, that would be fantastic. So I'd love to include as many of these groups and accounts through social media as possible.
Right. I'll give you a list.
Thank you.
That's a good idea. And Zach, you are one of these, you know, connectors through your podcast as well. And for us, it's and that's something we also have neglected a bit. How do we connect these local voices to higher macro, meso level, global level networks in a good manner, without, you know, just showing or what they do or where they can also contribute and tell their own stories, and where a higher system can learn from their knowledge. And they also benefit then because they're getting support and new knowledge, for example. I think that's something we really have to work on. It's still not really happening.
Well, you know where to find me if you want any, if you want my help in any way, feel free to get in touch. I'd love to be as helpful as possible to the project. I love the project and love the fact that you keep coming back so kindly and generously and talking to me about it. I was going to ask, actually, as the next phase kind of kicks in, then maybe we're looking at another debate, another chat to see how that works, how the transition goes on. So always something to look forward to. So I thank you both again, and look forward to those future chats.
Thank you very much.
See you soon.
And Mike. And Mike.